the recording. We started off here with the social signal processing chain as Venturelli proposed it. And the first thing that we need to do is to split up the signals according to the respective persons. And that can be done in various ways. If you're interested in audio, that is verbal behavior, you would use things like person detection, speaker diarization, speaker segmentation. And we started discussing these things. And one word of caution, it is not necessary that you understand all these machine learning technique details, which I presumably don't as well, right? At least for all the details. So it's the way I would suggest that you should approach these things is if you go through the slides and if you read through the respective survey article and you come to a certain topic that's of interest to you, let's say speaker diarization, okay? There are several survey articles that are referenced in that particular survey by Alessandro Venturelli. And my suggestion would be, as the extended approach, to take one of the surveys and try to study that. Okay? And you will come across terms like whatever dynamic time warping, hidden Markov models, and so on. And the goal would be to get a rough understanding of what these things are, okay? What they do, what their basic construction principle is, and I'll be giving you an example in a few minutes, how I would suggest you to try to understand that if you want, okay? And for those that say, well, I'm really not into machine learning, it's okay, then just try to grasp what the possibilities of these things are, right? So what they basically work like. You always have data input. You have some model training of some sort, classifiers in most cases. And in essence, they would map your pattern space to several classes. That's what classifiers do, as we discussed. And there is countless possibilities to do so. And people would choose appropriate features, appropriate feature reduction, if necessary, appropriate classification systems to solve the respective problem, right? So that's the basic understanding, right? So all the details that people developed are in essence often the attempt to increase accuracy from, let's say, 82% to 86%, right? But there is no thing, as you would say, that a reasonable standard approach would yield way inferior results than some super sophisticated fine-tuned stuff from a paper with 30 pages or so, right? There is differences naturally in, let's say, 10, 15% of accuracy, but it's not that the one would score 10% and the other one would score 99. I think from my experience, that is never true, right? So this is just to motivate that you should try to grasp the basics. Pick out one classifier, right? So we talked about Gaussian mixture models for clustering. I also gave you an example how to use Gaussian mixture models as class conditional densities in generative classifiers, and that could be something that you can try to understand. And for the audio stuff, as we saw, Gaussian mixture models are typically used these days still, for example, for the speech non-speech classification, right? There is other groups that fancy more sophisticated stuff, like recurrent neural networks, which are quite hip at the moment. But, well, there's no need. If you're not interested in that, in these things, there's no need to go into these depths, okay? If you're looking for a good machine learning introduction, well, just to repeat that, there is three books, right? The first one is the book by Bishop, which is moderate in size, still sufficiently accurate and recent for our purposes, and it's well written, and from a teaching perspective, I think the best book for, well, this audience, okay? And it's available in large quantities in the library, well, that's the one I'd recommend. Then there is the book by David Barber, which I referenced in some of the places. This is a bit more extensive. It has about 1,000 pages. It covers things also quite decently, right? You can understand things quite okay from that book. And its biggest advantage is that it's totally free, right? So you can just download the PDF from the web legally. And so that's also a nice book that Patrick van der Smacht and his colleagues and myself used last year in the machine learning course as background reading. Third recommendation is the book by Murphy, which is not freely available or available for free, but it's the most extensive, most thorough, mathematically most precise, maybe, of these three books. And for those that are really into machine learning, this is the source to go for, right? Good. So we left off here with these speaker diarization problems, and we said, okay, first thing would be to split the rough audio signals in frames of, let's say, 30 milliseconds. We might operate for some of these subtasks with windows of frames. That means connecting several of the frames to a window, and use features from there, okay? And what you would always do is you would try to compute features from your raw signal, meaning that you map the raw signal to, in most cases, to a vector of features, okay? And in this audio case, what you normally do is you use these Mel-Sebstrom coefficients, which are, I don't know, 30, 40, 20, whatever subset you choose, and, well, let's say 10, 15, 20 energy-related features and several others, maybe zero-point crossings or whatever, right? And then you typically accept that, or you would apply feature reduction, as we had in the case for the games engineering students for the face recognition, where we briefly talked about principal component analysis. Don't know if I discussed that here. And that would be it. So that would be your starting point. And then you would use whatever classifier is handy to solve the problem, right? And we left off discussing these speaker transitions, and we said, okay, how can we do that? So once again, if that is time, and here we have the amplitude of some signal, yeah, audio signal, and we have some subdivision. May that be a frame or a window, we don't care for the moment. And we assume that here we have a speaker transition, meaning that up to that point we have one speaker, and from there on we have another speaker. And how would we do that? Okay, so there are several possibilities to do that, as we said. So we can, model segments with Gaussians. Like here we have a Gaussian, here we have a Gaussian, here, here, and for the other ones as well, right? And then compare, modeling with Gaussians means, as we said, a Gaussian is a function which has parameters mu and sigma, right? So if we're having an n-dimensional feature space, this is n plus n times n many features that you have to learn with the help of your feature vectors and maximum likelihood. just in the same way as we discussed for Gaussian mixture models, right? But here we only have one Gaussian, and that problem is readily solvable with maximum likelihood, okay? So you'll get a pretty decent point estimate for these quantities here. And then you compare these things similarity-wise. So for each temporal subdivision, you would have a probability distribution in the form of a Gaussian, which you can compare, right, with the help of KL divergence or symmetrized KL divergence, right? This was you could use that as a similarity measure for probability distributions. And we would find that these are similar and these are similar, whereas these are not similar, right? So you can then reason that somewhere in there must be a transition. And you can home in on these things and then more or less precisely determine this transition point. Another possibility would be, as I said, to model each of the segments, to model each of the segments with one Gaussian as well as a two Gaussian mixture model. This would always give you a higher likelihood than this, because this is a more expressive model than this. So you have more fitting possibilities. And if you do it properly, the likelihood would be larger. But the question is how much larger, okay? So since we assume that there is a transition somewhere, for all of these frames where there is no transition, the one Gaussian model should perform roughly as likely as the two Gaussian solution. So the increase in likelihood is not significant in the sense of testing, right? And for the transition frame or window, this difference is significant, right? Because there are two speakers which we assume to be substantially different. Yeah? Let's assume a man and a woman. Different pitches, different vocal characters, okay? And you can employ likelihood ratio tests to do that, okay? And finally, once we kind of have subdivided our signal into segments of several lengths, the question would then be to state who is this, who is this, and is this the same as this? Yeah. So we separated this into smaller turns, if you want, or candidates for turns. And then we're left with the problem of clustering these together. That's the first thing. And once we've clustered them, so that answers that problem, right? So clustering is completely without training. Or not completely, but in this case, at least conceptually without training, unsupervised, right? And here you can group together those turns or temporal segments where we know there is only one speaker, and we can decide upon the grouping just on the basis of similarity, right? So similarity with respect to the models or whatever. And then the last step, once you did the clustering, is to map each of the clusters to a speaker, right? And for a speaker, you have a trained model, right? So that's what, for example, voice recognition systems in Windows would require you speak several sentences so they can learn a model of your language, right? And then the two-class classification problem would for each of the segments be, is it you or is it someone else? And you can test that for each of the speakers that is in question. Okay, and this already illustrates that it's a hard problem once you don't have training data. If you are aiming at, let's say, social media services that make use of deliberate social situations that you encounter, then naturally you encounter a lot of people that don't have a trained profile on their devices, right? If they don't have a device at all, you don't have a chance anyway, right? If they have devices, the devices can exchange data, maybe profiles, maybe other things at different levels of abstraction, but this is naturally a hard problem. So these things typically work, let's say, for meeting scenarios where you would possibly know the participants in advance, right? And then you can have models for their language, and then you can map them to certain speakers, right? Otherwise, what you can do is map it to your own vocal model and then count the number of other speakers that are present, right? So you know it's me and five others, presumably. Things like that could be possible, but as I said, it's a hard problem. And the accuracies, if you use only one microphone, are very low. So it's a hard problem, okay? Even for humans. So we did experiments where, for example, we had a barbecue out there between those first two building fingers, yeah, and we recorded that barbecue. Each one had a microphone, several cameras, Orwell style, right? And we annotated for each half second who spoke when. It was a terrible work, right? A lot of people involved. But I personally also participated in the annotation, naturally, because I was the initiator of the experiment. And, it is hard to decide who's talking when. And even it's even hard to decide whether the person wearing the microphone is talking at a given moment in time. So, and that's for humans hard, and it's also hard for computers, right? And for the clustering, what we can use is bottom-up clustering, as in case for single link or complete link, right? And we merge segments that have similar models, right? So then we get a bottom-up dendrogram, as in case of single link and complete link clustering. And we can cut the dendrogram according to several measures, for example, the total likelihood or something, okay? And there is countless systems that alter these proposed steps in various ways. They integrate step one with step two and step two with step three and use completely different techniques in step one. So there's a lot of variation out there, but these are, at least one basic approach to cope with that problem, okay? Now, if you don't have audio and if you try to do it with video, right, and you also want to split the respective streams split them according to which person is the owner of which part of the image, right? So, for example, to distinguish your gestures from my gestures, then you might do this with the help of face detection or body shape detection. And this is also a very hard problem, right? So if you're having 1,000 times 1,000 pixels, you're having only black and white type of information, then at least you're having a million features. So it's necessary to kind of come up with a different set of features, right? So the pixels are, too many features, and it's also very hard to train a classifier that would state this is a face, for example, and this is not a face, because while in audio, the background models, so for example, for deciding speech against non-speech, are, there's a limited range of possible audio noise types, I would say, yeah. But in terms of images, there is so many variations of non-face that it's very hard to train a reasonable model, as far as I know, right? So what you can do instead is to try to detect and correlate certain facial features like eye positions and skin patches like cheeks or chins or something, and then try to correlate and detect these. And the advantage is that these things are robust against, or comparatively robust against, rotations. Because as you can imagine, we're not in the ancient Greek times where statues were like this, right? People tend to move, right? That's only natural. So my face is sometimes depicted like that, sometimes depicted in its full glory from the front, and sometimes even from the side, right? And that makes this problem even harder. And if you're able to detect and correlate the positions of those particular sub-features, then, and base a model and a classifier on that, it's more robust against these rotations, okay? And there's, a plethora of theories about which features we should use. And there's also techniques like this cited ADA boost, which uses a intelligent combination of comparatively naive, small, not very necessarily very reliable small classifiers that are responsible for certain aspects, and then combine them to a more intelligent classifier, right? And this is something that at least works better than other approaches, okay? And so that was about face detection. Well, as you know, basically, face detection is something that is built into every camera, every smartphone. Even Facebook does it somehow. Yeah, so it's certainly something that you can solve, but it requires some machine learning approaches, right? And then the second step would then be, if I detected the faces, that this is somehow parallel to detecting the respective speaker segments here, then I would also have to do something in parallel to identifying speakers, namely to recognize the faces, right? So you know where the faces are, but who does that face belong to? And this, for example, you can do with also a lot of classifiers, but we can use this combination from the lab course, from assignment 4, where we would use PCA and, for example, K-nearest neighbors classifiers, right? And this PCA was a technique to reduce the pixel-based images to a reasonable subset with reasonable variation, right? So this is PCA. What PCA does is rotate the coordinate system, such that the axis point into directions of large variance, right? And then throw away those dimensions of those axes in the new coordinate system, the new rotated coordinate system, that correspond to small variances. Keep only those where the variance is large, right? And large variance means I have something to distinguish faces upon, right? My example from the last sessions was always, if I give you the features the number of eyes, it's almost worthless because the variance is zero. Yeah, so there are only very, very few cyclope persons from ancient history, right, that have one eye here, right? And it's clear that you should stick to features that have more variance. And these directions of high variance are called eigenfaces. Why? Because they are the eigenvectors of the covariance matrix, that is the empirical covariance matrix that is made up of all your training faces, right? So if your training face is some 10,000 dimensional, let's say, vector from 100 times 100 pixels, you would stick them all together in a large matrix, yeah? And you would then call this matrix X, because your measurements are sometimes or always, or in most cases, called X. And you would then have multiplication with X transpose, and that is, once you subtracted the mean vector mu from all of these, This is then the empirical covariance matrix, right? And if you want to compare this to your intuition, right, so covariance would be something like xi minus mu, xi minus mu transpose, yeah? So that's also something we understand by variance, right? And this is exactly the same, just in matrix notation. And this is your matrix that you deal with, and the directions of high variance are just the eigenvectors of this empirical covariance matrix, right? So it's a symmetric real matrix, and thus the eigenspectrum is well behaved, and you can choose top down those with high variance, right? And that's the idea of face recognition with eigenfaces. It's a very simple approach, right? There are way more sophisticated classifiers out there, but at least it's one approach. Now, if you don't want to stick to faces, so faces would be, for example, if you want to go for facial expressions, facts, action units, yeah, emotion detection. But if you want to, go for other things, interaction geometry, whatever, you would need to detect human figures in images, okay? And while faces, face detection-wise, are rather similar, right? They are round. They are somehow rosy beige in color. They have these two patches in the middle, the long patch there and the small red patch there. All the faces roughly look the same. So it's easy to detect faces, but it's less easy to detect figures because, well, this for a computer is a very significant pattern, but it just doesn't have anything to do with my figure, right? It's just my shirt. So there are too many options, again, for pixel features in terms of clothes, accessoires, postures, whatever. So we'd have to come up with something different. And what people use would, for example, be histograms of directions of detected edges, right? So edge detection algorithms, kind of, there are a lot of out there, and you can then do statistics on the directions of these edges, yeah, in order to come up with an estimation for these red boxes that are intended to mark down the human figures, okay? And, that's something that's, in essence a bit harder, even harder than the audio thing. In some aspects, it's simpler because, all in all, it's a problem with varying accuracy, right? But the face thing really works very well, right? So every decent camera or non-decent camera has these things on hardware as a chip. So, it's at least possible with decent accuracy, but it kind of varies according to the, for example, the lighting conditions, right? If there's very poor lighting, if you want to do these in, let's say, an underground club, yeah, where everything is dark and music is loud, then this is almost impossible. And if it's too dark, this is also not very easy, right? Well, speaking of other things, so we said that physical appearance can also act as a social signal. And this has to do with, let's say, body shape. It has to do also with attractiveness, okay? And there are a lot of studies, surprisingly, that investigate what is attractive, okay? And, if you set aside these privacy issues, it is of value, for example, to know who's attractive. Let's assume that for the moment in an image, okay? So the question is, how do you algorithmically assess attractiveness or beauty, okay? And there have been studies that did, for example, the following experiment. So if you take, let's say, 100 women's pictures and well, align the faces, morph them together, you would get something like this. So you can see that the hairdo is quite something average. And you can do the same with males, okay? And it turned out, surprisingly, or not surprisingly, that the morphed women images were perceived by a number of test persons of whatever gender to be very beautiful, whereas the guys, the morphed guys, were perceived as, okay? And that's, why is that? Because women's faces are more suitable for this morphing process, because what men would consider attractive is, let's say, rounded shapes. Well, so a woman that has a face shape like this wouldn't necessarily be, well, considered attractive by most men, whereas in the other way around, these pointed edges would correspond to a high testosterone expression in childhood. Well, large jaws, stuff, and very edgy faces. You can see that with every attractive person. Brad Pitt, George Clooney, all of them have very edged faces, yeah, and very, like, things like this, yeah. So, and these edges are then morphed away in a certain sense, so this doesn't really apply. But what these images and these experiments show, that there's several criteria that we assess in terms of attractiveness, and one of the main criteria is symmetry, right? So a symmetric face would always be considered more attractive than a non-symmetric face. Why? Because symmetry is an indirect indicator of properly working gene expression, right? Because certain tissues are supposed to develop in a symmetrical fashion, for example, your eye position. And if they don't develop in a symmetrical fashion, if you're skewed in some way, then this is an indirect indicator, at least on average, for some malfunction in gene expression. And that's what you as an individual that's after mating and reproducing would consider not as attractive, right? Because you would want something that is okay, in a sense. These are all things that are just on average. And once again, you can come up with a classifier, right? You can try to build a classifier that tells you how beautiful a face is, right? So if you want to have several classes, or even something like a regression model that gives you a degree of attractiveness. I don't know how far this has been driven, but at least it's something that is possible to address. Now you might, once again, if we step back on this meta level and ask ourselves, okay, what about privacy? What about human issues? Yeah. What about the whole ethical debate on these types of services, right? And once again, I don't have the impression that the value of these, the possible value of knowing these things would counterbalance the privacy risks and the ethical issues, right? I mean, it could be whatever. You can come up with a lot of fantasies on how you would use that in social media, online dating, or whatever. But it's, for example, there's a reason why in the U.S. it is not very well accepted to have your face in an application for a job, right? In the U.S., people wouldn't come with a photo. And that's because they do not want to, have these effects of these halo effects of hiring more beautiful persons with a higher probability than less beautiful persons, right? It's the same as if you were doing research on intelligence levels, right? So it is okay if you do that on the population in large, to, for example, devise strategies on how your school system should look like, how many require special attention, and so on. But it would be completely unethical to come up with research that tries to assess intelligence with respect to race, for example, right? So even if it turns out that, let's say, white people are less intelligent than black people or something, yeah? What would be the consequence, right? So there is, I think there is ethics in research per se. So not every research in itself is justified because it's research. There's also things where you as a researcher can already anticipate the negative uses of that. So be aware and always ask yourself, what does the benefits, do the benefits outweigh the dangers? Yes.
I mean, hypothetically, we all know that the studies that show that black people are less intelligent are, we know that.
Yes.
Hypothetically, let's say that we found scientifically that certain races have problems.
Yes.
That information would be useful for educators. It would be valuable for our school system. It's what we do with it that's the ethical issue.
Yeah.
And I can't really agree with stopping that kind of research on the ground.
Yeah, sure. So just to repeat that for the recording, the counter argument was that if we knew such things, we could also use them in a beneficial way, right? So it's not only about these weird racist things, right? But also they could be used for educators, right? But I would again counter argue, and then we have to continue, that there is things where the negative potential outweighs the benefits. And in that case, I would strongly argue, if I were to decide upon funding for research, I would not give funding to a research project, at least if the reasoning wasn't really properly made, right? If people made their points and they would say, for this and this particular purpose, with this and this publication policy and this use, okay? I'm not saying that I would deny everything, right? But, yeah. Per se, yeah. Yeah, so there is certainly a validity. So I'm not putting you in the evil corner, right? So I can follow your argumentation, and I had this type of argument what was her name? She's a very famous social media researcher, and I met her at a conference, and we argued about these things, right? And she said, okay, I'm just doing science. Well, she was into things like predict personality traits from social media behavior and so on and so on, which is also can be problematic, but it's not necessarily so. And she said, okay, I'm just a researcher, and that's what I do is neutral. Right? So, and people can use things in this way or in this way. So I'm as a researcher, I'm basically not responsible for my findings, because the findings themselves are, in a sense, beyond valuation, right? If things are provably as they are, it's a result that per se is not good or bad, right? Logically, that's true. But I would still stick to the argument that we should think about how to use that. Okay, you could argue the same about the whatever metallurgic properties of plutonium, right? So it's certainly okay. I mean, plutonium is just an element, and it comes at various, well, solid state phases, cubic lattices and other lattices and melting points and phase transitions. You can do research on that, right? But it's obvious that somehow, yeah. But still, it's not an argument that I would per se, a discussion that I would per se deny. Yeah. But well, let's leave that. Okay. Gesture detection. Okay. The review article is from 2006 or 7, if I'm not completely mistaken. So it's comparatively old already, comparing it to the pace of research. So the first statement might already be a bit outdated, right? So I think that there are studies out there that, try to assess the gestures or interpret them as social signals. However, gestures are clearly important as UI elements, right? And we all know that. So this gesture, if you ever watched a two-year-old skip through an old-fashioned photo album, he would always try to do things like this, right? Even a three-year-old would do that. Why? Because he's so used to these UI type of gestures. Uses, well, automatic sign language, interpreters, whatever, right? And, well, what are the challenges modeling-wise? So, first of all, you would have to detect body parts, right? So I would have to distinguish a hand from an underarm or from an upper arm, something like that. So what people use there is histograms of oriented gradients. So that's a fixed term, HOGs, which we don't want to go into too much detail about. And once they have their features, yeah, then as in the case of audio, you would have time series of these feature vectors, right? So in essence, the problem would then be, well, I have a feature vector at point T, another feature at T plus one, and so on, right? So these types of time series of feature vectors, whatever these may be or how large they might ever be, right? And then you would have to classify these series. So you would have something like this, for example, a time series of underarm features or whatever, or a time series of angles, right? Just your joint angles, and then try to interpret this as one of 10, 15, 20 gestures. That's a classification problem. And, you could pack together, let's say, these things up to XT plus 100 and try to classify this as a whole, okay? Which is hard because you don't know where the gesture actually starts, okay? So another technique would then be to use, dynamic Bayesian networks, DBN. So these are, in essence, machine learning models that have time built in some sort, right? And one of the, one well-known example classifiers or model systems that involve time are hidden Markov models. And how do they work? Okay, so hidden Markov models have two basic ingredients, right? So what they have is, they are latent variable models. Okay, so remember our discussion on Gaussian mixture models. So the latent variables corresponded to the hypothetical generative process of which Gaussian generated which pattern, right? And this information we considered a latent information, something we don't know, okay? And the same is true for hidden Markov models. So what they have is some internal working, right? And these we might call Z, and these are the latent variables. And in a sense, this is just a normal Markov chain, right? So if you have, let's say, five possible internal states, you have a 5x5 transition matrix to the new state. So there's an ongoing sequence of internal states that you assume to exist and that you assume to, be responsible for the outputs, right? Because at each stage, there is an output that is solely dependent on the internal states, right? And again, if you have, let's say, M internal states and N output variables, right? You have an M times N probability matrix that internal state 15 generated each of the 100 outputs with a certain probability, right? Generates feature number 35 with a probability of blah, 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 yeah? So roughly, okay? And this is then called the transition model, and this is called the output model, okay? And you can substitute almost all the models in machine learning for each of them. In most cases, this is a discrete Markov chain, and that could also be a continuous Gaussian model, for example, right? And then, well, in the end, what you only have is the outputs, right? So remember, here, sorry for having to go down and up. Was it there? No. Where did I put it? I erased it, sorry. So you only have your observations as a time series, those X, right? And if you, for example, want to go for speech recognition or so, for speech recognition, HMMs are typically used, right? So you have your phonetic output and you want to assume what kind of small word segments these generated, right? And then you can conclude back which word was actually spoken. And if you have these output series, you can once again train the model, okay? And the respective algorithm would then train all the transition probabilities from here as well as these output probabilities, right? Just from the observed sequence. This is called Baum-Welch algorithm, and it's an instance of expectation maximization, just as for the Gaussian mixture models, right? So, well, if you have a model that involves latent variables, okay, your reasoning in EM roughly would always be, I don't know about the precise workings of my latent quantities. I compute an estimation, how they work, and on the basis of that estimation, I compute what the possible outputs would be. And then I would refine my internal model, would then refine my output, and always in this alternating fashion, as with the Gaussian mixture models, right? Responsibilities, compute them with current mu, sigma, and pi, then do a new estimation of pi, mu, and sigma on the basis of the responsibilities and alternate. That was Gaussian mixture models. Same you could do with HMMs. And, well, this is the learning algorithm. And once you have, once you trained your model, you can ask questions such as, given an output sequence, what is the most probable latent quantity sequence, latent state sequence, right? That would be the Viterbi algorithm, yeah? Or you could ask, if I have, well, I have Z1, Z2, until, let's say, Z100, and I have my outputs, X1, X2, until X100, right? And one thing could be if I have X101, what is Z101? Yeah? So that would be a simple prediction task. Okay? And, well, this is interesting not as a point-wise prediction, but because of you're having a history, right? So if I speak the word history and I end up with histor, yeah? Then the Y is much more probable than the A, yeah? Because of the history. And if I only have that part of my utterance, that part of the WAF file, and it's maybe not very maybe it's similar, yeah? Just choosing only from that input, yeah? But given the whole previous sounds, for example, it's much more probable that you have the Y instead of the A, Okay? And that's why HMMs kind of respect the history. And you could also ask, well, what was Z50, right? Well, you can use X1 to X50 in the same fashion as here, but you can also use your evidence from the future, okay? And that's called a filtering task, right? So let's assume I speak something that sounds like history, and I want to know, is that a T or a P, right? And I can, well, if I only use that, his, yeah, then T can be probable, but P can also be probable, Hispanic, for example, right? But if I'm given the whole history, then it's much more probable that this was a T than it was a P, right? So this is called a filtering task. And, well, HMMs have a lot of applications, very interesting and rather simple in essence, right? Because, well, in essence, the total likelihood here is just if I have a sequence Z from 1 to T and I have an output from 1 to T, the joint probability would just be I have something at the beginning and then I have a product of the state transitions, Zt given Zt minus 1. So these are just these transitions for all of the steps multiplied, right? Yeah, over, you should have this over T, right? And then also multiplied by T and then P of XT given ZT, right? And this is the total likelihood, current joint probability. And this you can use, for example, to then transform this to expressions of P of ZT given whatever, Z1 to T minus 1 and your X, just by using Bayes' rule, right? Sorry. And that would be, well, something like this, I'm sorry, this filtering task, okay? If you leave out that, so you have to integrate over those. I'm sorry. Obviously, like tuberculosis in the end stadium. Whatever. So, other techniques are, well, that are involved are dynamic time warping. Sorry. And what is that? Okay, good. So, speaking of time series, right? And still using this speech recognition example. There are certainly people that speak things in a different way, right? So if you're having someone from Texas, he might say history. Yeah. And if you have like a British person, he might say history, right? And this is completely different, right? And it sounds different. So, and it's not only sound-wise, it's also length-wise. Because people have, I speak very slowly compared to someone from Spain, okay? So what you have to do is to correct things time-wise, okay? And this is done by TTW algorithms. And what you do here is, if you have one sequence, A1, A2, let's say to A50, and the other person speaks something that is a bit longer, like B75, right? And if you want to know whether these are actually the same things, what you must assess is whether these symbols match, right? Or whether they have a matching like A2 matches with B10 and A7 matches with B14 and so on. If that is the case, then you have an indication that this is the same word as this, but this is spoken only a bit slower. Okay? And that's what TTW does. I'm so sorry. Jesus. Good. So, well, same is possible for gesture and posture, right? You could use these things, as we said, for affective states, right? This is a different posture than this, right? And you can, well, conclude from that what's the matter. And, well, do studies on that. Gaze detection, face, gaze and face and their relations, also possible, analyze direction of eyes and so on and so on. Good. Well, and that's certainly something that's also a bit difficult. As I said, extract features, eye position, relative things, shapes of the involved geometric sub-elements and so on. Okay, so let's skip that. Now, well, one problem that we might be able to understand because it's comparatively easy is how we should deal with temporal sequences, okay, in images. Now, I gave you the example of speech and the variations in speech. Now, if you're having a series that goes like this, so a person makes the transition, right, from here to here, let's say, right? So from a rather nice face to a rather evil grin, okay? Then if we just extract one action unit, let's say the left eyebrow, what this does is pixel-wise, the actual images, the actual pixels that make up the eyebrow make a shift, right? So they just rotate from here to here, okay? So let's say this pixel here, this corner of the eyebrow, what does that do? That pixel moves down, okay? So this is the position at point T, and this is the position at point T plus 2, right? It just moved down. And what you want is to know what position a feature has as a function of time, okay? And how can you do that? You can use optical flow, and that is, as I said, it's comparatively easy, right? So what we want is we have pixels and we have intensities, like black and white type of image, okay? And we know the eyebrows are rather dark, whereas the rest of the face is rather bright, okay? So we want to know how the respective dark edge of the eyebrow moves. So we want to induce a vector field V that is dependent on the X and the Y direction and on time. Okay, that's what we want. And thus the intensity is a function of X, Y, and T. That's what we want. And we can make a Taylor approximation, first order, of that intensity vector field. And we can get this, okay? This is just first order Taylor approximation. And so we know that the intensity of this eyebrow corner at this position at point T is the same intensity as this eyebrow corner at this position, a bit more down, at the point T plus 2 or T plus 50, okay? So we can set this expression equal to this expression, meaning that this first order term must be 0, okay? Because the same pixel with an intensity of 50 has moved just to a different position in space and time. So, and that is the 2D optical flow equation, right? Because this term must be zero because that intensity must be equal to that intensity, okay? And that's why we're having this optical flow equation. And then you can use numeric methods to solve that, and then you have your desired, well, vector field or scalar field V of X and Y, and then the derivation would be the velocities, for example, right? And this you can use as features for detecting gestures, because if I do a winking gesture, what happens is that the pixels of my hand just keep on moving from here to there, right? And back. And if I do that 5 times, then I have a characteristic pattern that I can detect, right? And these pixel coordinates in time and space you can find, for example, with optical flow, okay? Good. And, well, people keep on asking me about the exam, and I would repeat the machine learning, as I explained on the blackboard, is certainly not deeply part of the exam, except for the stuff that's on the slides and that is explained on the slides in a way that is self-contained, okay? And here I would say, okay, optical flow equation is something that one can understand, at least in principle, from the slide. So I would take the freedom to state, can you, for example, give a short derivation on the idea of the optical flow equation? What would you use that for, and why is that term zero? Yeah, something like that. That is different from all the explanations I gave on HMMs, because these were just background infos for your understanding. These things are on the slides, and thus I would say, at least in principle, comprehensible from the slide. So this is somehow a difference, a tactical advice that I give you in terms of the exam. Do not learn all of that if it doesn't interest you. Yeah. Just get a very rough idea of what HMMs are, but I probably wouldn't ask that, yeah? But if things are on the slides, make up your mind about them, right? That's what I would suggest. So that's, I know that it's difficult to balance that, right? Other lectures just have everything logically developed on the slides. For example, math, right? If I would have to do calculus, I can give you proofs and I can do everything step by step by step. And then you precisely know what to learn. Here it's more difficult, right? So you're having a lot of concepts that you fuzzily understand, and you're having others that you're maybe supposed to know a bit in more detail. And the question is, oh my God, how am I going to decide what to do? First of all, It is a hard problem, and it's not only hard because of my lecture. It's hard because that's a typical situation for you in computer science. As I said in the beginning of the lecture, you have to be able to deal with this type of information. Quickly get an overview of something, have an idea what the basic bricks do and how they work together, but not lose yourself in the details. And try to understand crucial ideas, crucial key ideas of these things in order to be able to know the functioning of the bricks. That's all, right? And that's an art form. And I personally practiced that over the years, but I had a hard time, and I'm not far from good in that, yeah? But I also had a hard time when I was a student. When people presented me concepts that I would not be able to fully comprehend on the basis of the slides only. I would say, what an idiot. What does he dare to present me stuff like that? It's not well structured. I cannot understand that. Yeah. And then I started to read books and pile books and read other books. And this is not efficient, right? So I have a story of a mathematician, math student, very talented guy, and but he was so fanatic about understanding everything that once he was confronted with, let's say, some algebra in a calculus type of context, he would stop his learning, take an algebra book of 500 pages, and start working through this page by page. Yeah? And then he would trace back. Next thing, he would encounter something about geometry, which he doesn't understand. He would take a 5,000-page book on geometry, start with page 1, end with page 5,000, trace back. It's clear this is not very efficient, right? So you would have to deal with half knowledge in some sense. Just to calm you down, this is not to challenge you. It's just to say, I know that it's difficult, and it's not a problem if you... There are so many questions in the exam because it's overloaded. If you don't know some of them, so be it. If you have a rough understanding of everything, it's cool, right? So don't be afraid. You can leave that out. So if a question like this comes, well, I cannot say anything about it. Maybe I can say 2 words and get 2 out of 10 points. Well, so be it. If you happen to know everything else, or at least a substantial part of that, it's okay. Yeah. So this is the idea of the whole approach, right? To calm you down. Good. Total signals from audio, as I said, well, prosody was pitch, tempo, and energy. That was what we discussed. And pitch, you could, for example, try to assess via a Fourier transform. So it could be the first fundamental frequency of the Fourier transform, right? So the first maximum in a sense. But there are more sophisticated methods to determine a pitch. So pitch is just a value, a frequency value, where you would say this is the typical frequency of that particular voice, right? And one approach would be Fourier transform the signal, take the most dominant frequency in the Fourier spectrum and take that as the pitch, right? As I said, more sophisticated things out there, right? Tempo is a clear indicator of your emotional state. It's also a clear indicator as a social signal, right? If I talk very fast, it can mean I'm aggressive or I'm trying to impress you or I'm trying to... well, convey much information or many information in a small number of time units. And that, again, you can interpret in various ways, right? So if you happen to know whatever my heart rate at the same time, and if you happen to know my speech tempo, you can try to conclude whether I'm in an agitated state or whether I'm just someone from whatever, southern Italy that speaks about twice as fast as me, right? So that is something you have to know and you have to interpret. Is that a social signal or is it just a cultural variant, right? And here, you, for example, if you can detect vowels, you can count vowels per second as a means for assessing the tempo. And the energy, as I said, would be proportional to the square of the intensity. Right? Just to have a rough estimation of how loud somebody speaks, which again is an indicator of possibly of a brawl going on or a discussion going on. And as Vinciarelli said, and I'm not sure that this is still right, there are not so many efforts in terms of laughter detection or sigh detection, stuff like that. Non-linguistic vocalizations. But it's clear that this does play an important role, right? So laughter is a clear indicator of the quality of a social situation. So if laughter keeps on recurring, you know that it's not a heated discussion, possibly, probably, okay? And, well, once again, if you're after laughter detection, you would use these models, right? So you would, for example, employ an HMM or employ other audio processing techniques. So silence detection, you can use energy. And this is also important if you want to characterize the dynamics of the turn takings, right? If there is long silence periods, yeah, what can that mean? It can mean that, for example, whatever, there's something like a bad mood. Yeah. If you want to separate from your partner, typical discussions are either very heated, you evil person, no, you're the evil person, or they contain lots of, well, depressive silence. Not everything has been bad. Yes, but we have to separate anyway. Things like that. And, well, silence is an indicator of social signals. Okay? Once again, assess that with a classifier using energy features. Okay? Now, that was that on, well, how to actually model things. Just a rough overview. Now, what Alessandro also stated was in his basic social signal processing chain, context is also something that does play an important role. Now, remember what we said about context. Well, we kind of defined that in the second slide's head. Yeah? And we said that the basic idea of the lecture is to derive social contexts. Now, every social interaction in itself is also does also take place in other contexts. For example, in adverse weather, as the one that's currently going on outside. Well, and whatever. It makes a difference if a social interaction takes place, let's say, in a club or at the Wiesn, compared to an interaction taking place here in the lecture hall. And this context influences your interpretation, right? So, for example, if you detect heated emotions and a heated discussion is going on, you would know that with high probability, this is like a content-oriented scientific dispute if it goes on here in that academic environment. Whereas the same heated discussion, without regard to the content, if it takes place on the Wiesn, right, you might know that this is more likely to end up in a beating and a brawl. Yeah? The same indicators, but in a different context, you have a different influence on the probabilities. And naturally, this is a difficult problem. And, well, you would have to kind of include them in some way. Yeah. And another important issue is how to combine your social signal assessments. Okay, because, for example, you have an agent running on your mobile phone. Other persons have agents running on their mobile phones. Their agents would assess the situation as heated, whereas my agent would say, it's just a normal discussion. What are you? Yeah. And humans have a subtle way of kind of fusioning these opinions, right? So this is again mediated via social signals, right? So if you're standing together with five persons, right, and a heated discussion is coming up, every single one of the five persons knows that a heated discussion is coming up. It's rarely the case that only one thinks this is a really heated discussion. You can privately think this is a controversial topic that we're currently discussing. But if you don't translate it into social signals, it's your private, the mind is free, right? But once this process is going on, everybody seems to know what's going on because of social signal exchange. Now, the agents would have to do something similar, right? If my agent thinks that here four persons interact with me, and one of these four persons thinks that there's only an interaction of three. How would we do that? And this is a field where we worked, and we used, for example, subjective logic approaches for, well, multi-level fusion of raw data, of intermediate results, and even high-level results. But that's something that's also in its childhood, right? Not very well developed. Okay, good. How can we apply these things? Okay. Well, Alex Pentland has done a lot of stories, for example, to detect the outcome of some dyadic interaction, let's say in a call center type of interaction or in a selling type of interaction. Yeah? And you're quite reliably able to predict whether a selling interaction would be successful or not, just based on the social signals. Okay. What they also did was to assess influence or, well, basic exertion of social force, right? Who is the more powerful in an interaction? To assess how consistent it is or whether there's things going on such as mirroring, mimicry, and so on. What they also did was to come up with something they called eigenbehaviors. What they did there was they recorded features or raw measurements about 100 MIT undergraduate students. That was like 10, 15 years ago. And they equipped them with, at that time, modern devices, which kind of measured where they were and, into a very limited extent, what they did. Okay, and what they would then do is to split those time series of measurements for these 100 people according to time. Right. So they had a schema like this. So they had a day, and each day has 24 hours. And for each of those 24 hours, they have a characterization of whereabouts and what they did and so on. And they had the same thing for the next day and the same thing for the next day and so on. So in essence, the only thing that they did was to kind of group temporal measurements, because these are continuous, right? But they grouped them according to days, yeah? And that's a typical process of injecting external knowledge into the model, because you know that a day is a unit of time that has a significance in our lives, okay? And then the only thing that they did, they computed with PCA, computed eigenvectors of these things, of the covariances, and you could use that, for example, to detect that or distinguish persons that have a higher entropic life from persons that have a more ordered life, things like that. Okay, this is not strictly social signal processing. It's more like reality mining, yeah, because it doesn't involve actual social interaction. It focuses on individual behavior, right? Good. Lots of papers on role structures in small groups, detection of user interest, stuff like that. Good. Collective action recognition and action modeling is something that is also a large field, action recognition, activity recognition. And while this is also focusing on individuals, you might as well use the same techniques for detecting collective actions. Okay? For example, what you can do is you can take the features recorded from raw device measurements to decide whether two people are doing the same thing at a certain time. Right? This is what we call co-activities. Okay? And, well, whatever. Analyze users' reactions to algorithmic, robotic type of conversational agents and so on. And what the guys at Björn Schuller's group did, they analyzed talk shows, for example. At that time, it was Arabella Kiesbauer. I don't know if she's still active years ago. What they did, they transcribed whole episodes of her TV show, role-wise, interaction-wise, emotion-wise, and then try to reconstruct this with social signal processing methods, and successfully tried that. Okay, good. Good. Now, one short example from our research that I already introduced to the games engineering students, but the social computing persons would not have seen that yet. So what we were after was modeling social situations, okay? And so this is in a mobile social networking context, and we wanted to detect them as special forms of social context, right? And what we understood by a social situation was a co-located social interaction where every interactant is fully mutually aware of this existing social situation. So a very simplified model would only say, what are the persons that are involved in that situation, and what are the spatial and temporal limits, right? So how long does that interaction take, and where does it take place, right? So that's a very simple model. And it's, if you want, this is a prerequisite for more sophisticated social signal processing, right? So if you want to analyze and understand social situations, you must know that they actually exist, right? And the question is, how can we know that they exist? Okay, so we assume that, as I said, everyone has a personal social networking agent, works in a decentralized fashion, and they work together to assess what the person's, what the social situation is that the persons are in, okay? And, well, it's a subfield, if you want, of mobile social signal processing, because we rely on mobile sensors, okay? And how could you do that? One way would be to analyze the audio signals, do speaker diarization, and then conclude what are the interacting persons, right? Another way would be to use gyroscopes, accelerometers, ultrasound sensors, and so on to retrieve relative body distance and orientation, so interaction geometry, and then kind of infer the set of interacting persons. So that is about detecting a social situation, whereas understanding a social situation might use the same processing path, but then try to assess the emotions of the participating persons, right? Same thing, but then you would go a different way, okay? Now, we know from our discussion that there are statements about interpersonal distances, so the intimate zone, socio-consultative zone, friendship zone, and so on, so from Hall, and we know that there are other influences from architecture and so on, and there is also statements about angles that people would normally be in, right? It's only clear if we have an interaction like that, if three persons stand in something like this, they would call this F formations and make statements about the typical body angles that are involved. Okay, so the angles of the upper torso. And, well, you can ask yourself, is there a general quantitative model that takes the interaction geometry of two persons and assesses whether they are socially interacting or not? Okay? And you can also ask yourself, what is the use of such models and other things? Okay? So what we did was we conducted an experiment where we precisely measured these interaction geometry parameters. Okay, this worked with infrared beacons, which were detected by an array of cameras And it was, we attached that to the shoulders of our participants, and we knew exactly the distance between those targets and their orientation in space. Yeah? They had these reflecting globes on them. So that was something like the situation from above. And we computed for each pair of persons the relative orientation and the relative distance. Relative orientation is delta theta, and relative distance is delta d. And as I said, the idea is first to decide upon whether two persons socially interact. And once we know that for each dyad, we can then deduce what the group looks like that people interact in. Okay? So in essence, we wanted to have the probability of social interaction given these parameters. Okay? And what we did, we manually annotated our data set. Okay? So for each, we had 8 participants. Okay? So that means at each point in time, no, we had 9 participants, sorry. We had 9 over 2 pairs at each point in time. And for each pair, we needed to state whether this corresponded to persons being in a social situation or not. So if you find something like that, as an example, you know that this is a social situation and this, okay? So the green pairs are in the set of yes, they are socially interacting, and the red pairs are in the set of no, they are currently not socially interacting, okay? And, distance is just a scalar value, right? But we equip this with a sign. And the sign, the meaning of the sign is that if you have something like this, yeah, then the interpersonal distance from that person to that person is positive, whereas the interpersonal distance from that person to that person is negative, because this person is standing in the back of this, right? So this is a rough modeling of the polar angle, the positional angle of these two persons, just coarsely narrowing it down onto plus or minus 1. Well, and that's the result. I already showed this to the persons that were present in the introduction of assignment 4. So here on the x-axis, we have the relative angle. On the y-axis, we have the relative distance. And we see here it's the same, not as a heat plot, but just as a flat plot. And we see that this strip here is, the stripe here is just the intimate zone. Okay, and so nobody's here in that intimate zone whatsoever. These are the persons that stand in the back of others, and these are the persons that stand in front of the others. And everything is just 4 pairs of socially interacting persons. And we see that the typical average angle that they take is about 45 degrees. Yeah, so not a confrontative angle, but 45 degrees. Yeah, so pi half is a local maximum. And here we also see local maxima in the distances. And you can fine analyze this with respect to what is the arity of the respective social situation. Is it a social situation with 3 persons, with 4, with 5? This has its geometric implications, right? And Alex Lehmann did that. And for S minus, we see a much more diffuse pattern, right? So for socially interacting pairs, we would assume that this follows strict rules, yeah? So the distances are kind of fine-tuned, the angles are fine-tuned, whereas for non-interacting pairs, it should be like almost an even distribution. And that's what we basically see. And then, just last 2 remarks, what we did was we trained a Gaussian mixture model for each of the classes as class conditional densities, and then saw how accurate would the pairwise prediction be. And we saw that it's around 75% to 80%, which is comparable or better than other classifiers. Okay. Now, once we know for each pair of persons whether this pair is socially interacting, we can then say, okay, how can we conclude what the actual annery social situation is? And in order to do that, we employed graph clustering, right? So for each pair of persons, we computed a relative probability that they were socially interacting, then used average link clustering and maximum modularity dendrogram cut. All the things that we had, right? And then what we get is a partition of the set of possible persons into social situations via graph clustering. And then we can compare this partition with the annotated partition. And there we would use a RAND index or adjusted RAND index. And what we see is that it's substantially better than random. And, if you would use a random partition here, you would, for the adjusted RAND index, get something like 0.05 or something. So we're orders of magnitude more successful in retrieving the actual situations. Okay? So this works. We had several studies on how to measure distances and how to measure angles with the help of mobile devices. We can say that we have an algorithmically processable model of this social interaction probability, and we can even deduce the higher level annery situations from that pairwise interaction. And that's a typical processing chain for social signal processing. Raw measurements build a quantitative model that goes beyond the qualitative statements of the sociologists, right? So you can build that into a mobile device if you want, and then have a, well, admittedly primitive social assessment. So you're only stating these persons are currently interacting together in this space and time period. It's a very primitive analysis, but at least this works. And this is just meant as an example for you to understand that processing chain. Okay? So, and that was all for social signal processing. I'll quickly repeat that in the next lecture. But next Tuesday, we will then start with game theory, right? And if you have any sort of question, please don't hesitate. Come down, discuss things with me. So see you next Tuesday.